Soccer is possibility. In Chile, there is an expression, rayando la cancha, which means marking the field. It is what you do to transform a place into a soccer pitch, an action so common in Chile that the expression can be used to describe any kind of beginning. All you need is a ball. If you don't have one, you can make one. And even if you don't have one, you can play. This is what a group of boys do in the film Timbuktu by Mauritanian director Abderrahman Sissako, when the Islamist group that has taken over their town bans the sport and takes away their ball. In one of the most beautiful sequences I have seen in any film, the boys play the game anyway. They dribble and tackle, take a penalty kick, score a goal, celebrate. The ball is unnecessary in the end, because soccer, more than anything, is an idea. Soccer is life. In her account of traveling the world looking for pickup soccer games to join, former US collegiate soccer star and filmmaker Gwendolyn Oxenham writes of visiting a park in Rio de Janeiro. There, waiters gather after their restaurants close. They start playing at midnight and often keep going until dawn, delighting in the movement and creativity that defines Brazilian football. I wash the dishes. I sweep the floors. I put the chairs up on the table, one player tells her. And then I come here to play, to live. Oxenham understands. For as long as I can remember, she writes, football has been how I come all the way alive. Soccer comes from a specific place and time, the schools and universities of 19th century Great Britain. The laws of the game, which still govern how soccer is played, were first set down in 1863. Because of the country's dominant global presence, not only through the British Empire, but also through the British merchants and companies based outside the colonies, the game was soon on the move. It spread quickly. By the end of the 19th century, it was being played in Europe, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and throughout much of Africa, even in areas outside the British Empire's sphere of influence. The game has shown a remarkable capacity to flourish nearly everywhere it has taken root. Played in Senegal, it seems as completely Senegalese as any other form of local culture. Soccer is absolutely German. It is absolutely Argentinian. It is absolutely Haitian. And of course, it is perhaps, above all, absolutely Brazilian. In fact, the English often have to remind the rest of us that they were the ones who invented it. As perpetually beleaguered English fans know, at least when it comes to global competition, having invented the game hasn't given them much of an advantage. There are good reasons for soccer's universal appeal. It is a simple game, easy to learn and grasp. A few instructions, a finger pointed at the goal, and off you go. It is democratic in this sense, and also in the way that it accommodates all kinds of body shapes and sizes. In fact, many great soccer players are of slight or short physique. I love the way that small men can destroy big men, writes the novelist Nick Hornby, an ardent fan of the English club Arsenal. Strength and intelligence have to combine to make a great player. There are a surprising number of small goalies, for instance. Their ability to see and move and the size of their personalities is more important than their physical size. If you put Lionel Messi, often considered the best forward in the world, in a suit, he'd look at home in a cubicle in some office park, working as an accountant. One of the greatest strikers of all time, the Brazilian Manuel Francisco dos Santos, known as Garrincha, had bowed legs, an inheritance from disease and hunger suffered in his youth. As a result, he moved and dribbled in an unusual way. That was part of his brilliance, enabling him to constantly outsmart defenders. In his autobiography, the great Argentinian player, Diego Maradona, recalls how the president of the Italian soccer club Juventus once declared that with his physique he'd never go anywhere in the sport. "Football is so beautiful," Maradona writes, "so unlike anything else that it finds a way to fit everyone in, even dwarves like me." There is one major check on this openness to diverse body types. Soccer's global institutions, along with the soccer industry and media, are dominated by men. Sexism shapes the practice and representation of soccer everywhere, and in turn, soccer's gender divisions often play into and confirm stereotypes. Women's soccer struggles to gain equal recognition and financial support. The policies and practices that have excluded women depend on the idea that soccer is fundamentally male and that women are interlopers, or at least newcomers in the sport. This is an illusion. In fact, women have played soccer as long as men. In the early 20th century, women's soccer was hugely successful in England, drawing massive crowds to stadiums. Then, in 1921, the English Football Association banned women from using its fields and stadiums, essentially driving women's soccer underground. There were similar decisions made in other countries, but in the face of concerted opposition, women never stopped playing. In 1970, the first Women's World Cup was organized independently in Italy. The Women's World Cup was played in Mexico City, in the Azteca Stadium, where Brazil had famously won the Men's World Cup the year before. Footage and photographs from the women's games show a packed stadium. The 1971 Women's World Cup has been almost totally forgotten, even though the crowd appears to have been larger than that at the 1999 Women's World Cup final at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, usually cited as the women's soccer game that drew the largest live crowd in history. These are reminders, however, that soccer is, and has always been, a women's sport. Soccer is a language, probably the most universal language on the planet. It is spoken more widely than English, Arabic, or Chinese, and practiced more widely than any religion. In 1954, the French soccer journalist Jean Eskenazi wrote an essay on the universality of the game. It is, he declared, the only denominator common to all people, the only universal Esperanto, a world language, whose grammar is unchanging from the North Pole to the equator. Although mutually intelligible everywhere it is played, it is still delightfully varied, spoken in each corner of the globe with a particular accent. The Swedish writer Fredrik Ekelund similarly calls the game the Esperanto of the feet. The novelist Karl-Ove Nordgaard, who wrote a book of letters about the 2014 Men's World Cup with Ekelund, offers a vivid example of how this language works. Picked up once by a German truck driver while he was hitchhiking, Nordgaard found he had no common language with which to pass the time during the long ride. Then he began saying the names of soccer players. He started with a Norwegian footballer, Rune Bratseth, and the German recognized him. "Brightening up and repeating it several times," Nordgaard continues. "Then he said a name, so I said, ja, ja." These names, keys to a broader set of shared memories and experiences and feelings, were a thread of connection. Every soccer game is a story, but it is not easy to capture it in words. Why, wonders the Mexican novelist and journalist Juan Villoro, has there never been a great football novel? The answer, he suggests, may be that every game is already its own epic, its own tragedy, its own comedy, all at once. The works of literature that do try to narrate soccer, including many remarkable short stories, often do so by piecing together fragments of story, attempting to capture the way moments on the pitch somehow condense the drama of life.